Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. WHRO's Emmy-nominated digital arts initiative, The Scene, is halfway through its third season. So far, you've gotten to see a slice of life from local artists, including a world-renowned blues musician, a fabric artist, a ceramic sculptor, and a traveling band of seven siblings. So how do you find these hidden gems, and what happens once they're discovered? Let's talk about it after this news from NPR.
Shining, no sign of snow, fog, or rain. Why am I stuck in this traffic again? I got the HRBT, the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel Blues.
Oh, don't we all? That's our good friend Bobby Black Hat Walters. He's a harmonica player, a blues musician, and a writer, and he was featured in season 3 of The Scene. That song is just one of the songs that he's done about the region itself. He certainly is a national figure, happens to live here in Hampton Roads. We'll be talking with him a little bit later because he is one of the artists who's been featured on this tremendous project called The Scene, which is now in its third season. And it's a digital narrative, it's an online piece, it's also a broadcast piece. So there's a lot to it today, and we're glad to have you with us in the conversation. Shannon Bowman is a producer, and she produced essentially the concept for The Scene. Big picture, Shannon, what were you thinking here?
We knew we wanted to do a community interest blog dealing with the arts, and I think initially the station was looking at the broader picture of arts and the larger arts community that we have. And I kind of pitched the idea, well, if we were going to do this, could we look at more like street artists, performance artists, more at a community grassroots level?
Yeah. And that intersection is interesting to you, isn't it? Mm-hmm. This intersection of the national and the local.
Sure. Yeah. I think when I first started dealing with this topic and working with Kenny and the artist, I had this idea that there was this divide between, you know, high art and community art. Mm. And just through the process of working through this, I realized that art is just art, you know. Yeah. And even having national artists come here, they're part of our community of artists, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. So that divide has really been broken for me in my mind. And I hope that through the series, we've kind of broken down that as well. Because you see it a lot in the larger organizations.
It strikes me as well, if you look at what's happened with the arts in the region, mm-hmm. you know, all the way around, it's really been, I think, a very potent time here locally.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you look at events that the Chrysler is having, the Glass Wheel Studio, they all combine national artists with local artists. Mm-hmm. And it's just this collaboration, oftentimes by topic, you know, whether it's sea level rise or the environment or things like that. So they're breaking it down by theme, not necessarily by region or geography.
We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. We're talking about the arts as they are expressed locally. They are expressed online and on the air through a project called The Scene. That's one of the many ways this company sort of presents arts in the region. But this program called The Scene has really been across multiple platforms and featuring and highlighting some really interesting people in the community. We're at 10 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. And we're wondering where you connect with the arts in Hampton Roads. Have you noticed this more vibrant arts scene, this scene where that line, as Shannon talked about, this line between national art sort of coming here and local art bubbling up? Have you noticed that line blurring, and where do you fit into that? 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. You've had the opportunity to work with, well, yourself are a very creative producer, but you've also had the opportunity to work with a couple of other creative producers as well, one of whom is Danny Epperson, mm-hmm. who is certainly a treasure to this broadcast, and he's on this side of the glass today. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Kathy. It's very nice to be in here. I didn't know these walls were this color.
I know. Well, it's good. You're enormously talented, as are all the folks who are engaged in this project. How'd you get connected with it? And tell us about the story that you're going to bring us today.
Well, there's several.
Or the story that you've right. set up.
Right. One of the stories that, of course, having produced today's show as well, it's exciting to be able to talk about the scene on radio, as in it's an online series.
Yeah.
But I came to the scene, having been here at WHRO for several years and producing several projects. The scene is right up my alley, really, in enabling me to be able to even do more of my editing skills and bring more of that to play, as yeah. well as some in the field producing rather than here in the studio. The first, I'll tell you about the first, my first scene video. Was in Newport News with a fabric artist by the name of Sandy Curran. And so out the gate, it's Shannon's like, okay, this is one we think would be great for you to yeah. work on first.
And you knew instantly what a fabric artist
right,
was,
yeah,
didn't
and,
you?
And, well, yeah. you know, as it was told also, and some will say a quilter.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, a quilter, that's that's a rather a moving art, and then, so the first thing comes to mind is okay, bedspreads, you know,
yeah.
and bedspread that that my grandmother made.
Sure.
Well, I was soon to find out that that bedspread that it's not my that was not my grandmother's bedspread.
It strikes me that these projects also open you all as producers up, because this
absolutely.
Is your art, right? I mean, this is sort of how you're sharing your art.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And I enjoy being able to put together someone else's story. And, you know, Sandy Curran was a great way to start, I think.
Yeah. Sandy Curran joins us now. She is a fabric artist who was featured in season 3, episode 2 of The Scene. Her work is called The Blood Remembers. Sandy Curran, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm thrilled.
Well, did you, when you saw Danny Epperson come into your house, he was sort of looking, thinking he was going to be looking at quilts. So tell us about your journey as a fabric artist, because I understand this really connected with you on a very personal level and came through what I think many of us are confronting these days, which is caregiving.
Yeah, it did. It actually, I consider it my gift for taking good care of my husband's mother when she came to live with us. She was an angel, and I was looking for a way to keep her active and introduce her to some people closer to her age. And I found that through my church guild, and they were making quilts for to raise money. And I got involved, and that's how I got started. Very traditional quilts in the
yeah.
beginning.
So how did this evolve for you into something that was expressive of your own experience?
It's pretty strange, but partially because I'm a terrible housekeeper. I had a newspaper lying on the floor. It was back during the build-up to the invasion of Iraq, and it was the Daily Press, and it had a picture of Saddam Hussein's eyes above the fold, and below the fold was a map of Iraq. And it was just lying there on the floor, and every time I went by it, I was struck by how powerful this was.
Hmm.
And I thought, well, I'm going to make that instead of making, you know, a pretty little quilt. I'm going to make that, and I did.
Wow!
And it worked, and that's how I got started on what we call innovative or art.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting, because I think a lot of people might have looked at the picture, but not necessarily made the leap to fabric. But I guess this had just become a part of your life.
I guess. I'm not sure how that happened, to be honest with you. It's just, you know, most of my quilting friends were pretty shocked that I
yeah.
would pick a topic like that.
Well, they're really quite extraordinary. You can see them at sandycurran.com. That's SandyCurran.com. And Sandy has portraits that she's done, animals, nature, hand-quilted, her hand-painted quilts. She still does that as well. But these are really extraordinary. I think it's interesting too that how is it to work with fabric to tell these stories? I think a lot of people think of maybe paint or drawing. What does it do for you as an artist to work with something like fabric to paint these pictures?
Well, it's both limiting, and therefore it creates a barrier that you have to overcome. The limit is that when you're painting, you can mix your colors on the canvas, whereas when you're working with fabric, you have to mixture. You have to mix the pieces of fabric to create the image. And then the other side of it is, because of the fabric itself and the quilting you do on it, you have texture that's not available to painters.
Oh, it's such
Although some painters can build up texture.
Sure.
We have it as fabric artists as a part of our medium.
It's really interesting. So. Danny, where do we come to the Blood Remembers?
Well, you know, when I first saw quilting, and my first meeting with Sandy was at the Hampton Roads Convention Center, and it was the Mid-Atlantic Quilting Convention show. And so I was overwhelmed, and I was there with Shannon. We were really overwhelmed at looking at all the different types of quilts and how they were literally, they look like paintings. Mm-hmm. And I was just so impressed that, you know, the variety that was there, the different levels. So that really drew me in into going, wow, this is an art form that was not what I expected. You know, this was not my grandmother's quilting. And then when we were traveling through and seeing some of Sandy's works with her, one of the works that really struck me that she did was called The Blood Remembers. And it was a, you can see it, it's in the video that we feature, but it's a portrait of an elderly African-American woman, kind of contemplating, looking down, and it's an echo pattern. But inside of the quilt is written a poem that Sandy penned, which is extremely contemplative about what is going through that woman's mind. And to see the mixture of two art forms,
right,
poetry and fabric art, was just amazing. Mm. So to capture that and talk about why she created that and what process really kind of really gets down to what an artist is about.
It's really getting expansive in a form that might have been fairly traditional. Yeah. Danny, I'm going to let you go because you've got to go back and finish the job that you have for us today.
I'll see you on the
You're getting two salaries today, aren't you?
See you on the flip side, like I always say, right?
I know that. That's right. Danny Efferson's heading back into the control room. Sandy Curran, what's next for you? What do you see coming up next?
Oh, boy, I don't know.
You're a true artist. You're just going to be open to anything.
Well, right now, this week, I'm working on a baby quilt for my daughter who's having her first child.
I get
to go back to the traditional world and do something that's a whole lot easier than what I usually do. But I've been trying recently a little bit of more abstract work, and then I generally wind up kind of going back to my portrait. I like larger than life. If it's a flower, it's a flower that's 4 feet by 4 feet.
Nice.
If it's a cat's face, it's a 3-foot cat's face and things like that. I tend to like big pictures.
I gotcha.
So I don't know what comes next, though.
But I love that you're open to anything. Sandy Curran, thank you for being with us today. It's beautiful work at sandycurran.com, CURRAN.com. Thanks so very much.
Thank you very much. It's been very exciting for me because I'm a huge fan of yours.
Oh, thank you kindly. That's so nice. And I am a huge fan of yours, having seen your work. It's just gorgeous. Thanks so much. We're at 18 minutes past the hour, and we'll let you know that Sandy's work can be seen as part of the scene, that particular episode, Season 3, Episode 2. But what is really delightful is that all of these episodes are being brought to you on a fairly regular basis in television form. So you can watch them online. You can see them on television. Kenny Hopkins is a producer and editor here at WHRO, and he really was the creator of the look for these things. Kenny, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much.
How did you think through this this project to come up with the style?
Well, for me, you know, just kind of being a creative person and somebody who kind of keeps their eye and ear to like the creative scene, I was seeing a lot of people who were transitioning to DSLR cameras. So it's basically your typical point and shoot camera, but as their technology evolved, they started putting in stuff to where you can shoot videos. So what it was doing was creating a low cost object for people to be able to shoot this incredible stuff. So coming from the world that we're in, where everything is these broadcast cameras that could cost you you know, tens and twenties and $50,000. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden you had all of these street artists who are creating these videos with cameras that cost $3,000 to $5,000, that to me the look was just blowing our stuff away. So I had been a proponent within this building, WHRO, of let's find something we can do on a regular basis to kind of implement this DSLR work. So this was the first project we did, and it was funny. We actually rented a camera for our first couple shoots, and it was kind of like we had all this pressure to get all this stuff within this 7-day window that we could then create a trailer that would then kind of propel the project, which we did, and I think everybody was so pleased with the results that we've kind of gone to that technology as far as camera-wise with every project we do now.
It really has democratized things, hasn't it?
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
Really puts the tools that used to be reserved for so few into the hands of everybody, which is making for some very interesting art.
Yes, ma'am.
So tell us how it works then from these pieces that, you know, if people can certainly watch them at the WHRO website, and there's this, the scene has its own website, I believe, as well.
It's whro.org/the scene.
/the scene. But you've also put these, sort of strung these together in sort of a TV aspect to put on WHRO TV 15, right?
Yes, ma'am. After the first two seasons, we were looking at about 20 videos, and we were trying to figure out, hey, we have this medium right here. You know, we have this opportunity to post these things and show a whole different audience. Because that was one thing we were really going for with this project. We were really hoping to bring kind of a younger audience who lives on the web, where, you know, everybody's trying to cut the cable. So, but at the same time, we do have, you know, 4 television stations. So why wouldn't we just broadcast something? We have the opportunity. So last fall, we put together 6 shows that highlighted different things. And then we would do fun stuff. Since some people had already seen the footage, we would do like a live performance by one of the bands we had highlighted or something else. So like I said, last fall, we aired 6 episodes, and that went really well. And it's kind of been seen some nominations from a couple things. So
good.
That's been really cool.
You talked with Asa Jackson. So tell us about your interaction with, I think both of you did, right? Mm-hmm. Did you both, worked on this one, right?
Well, when we started this project, you know, and you alluded to it earlier, this area with the Neon District and the Vibe District and all these different places has this kind of burgeoning art scene right now. So it was easy when we were looking for our initial 8 artists just to pluck 8 from right here in Ghent, from right here in Norfolk. But me growing up kind of being this peninsula kid and moving away and then coming back. So I kind of have this newfound interest in the peninsula. And since I still live over there now and I, you know, bear with the dreaded HRBT blues every day, I kind of see the two different worlds. So when we started looking at the initial list, I said, you know, I really want to get some representation from the peninsula on there. And I'd come across Ace's work doing like we usually do, where we're trolling the internet and Facebook a lot. I'd come across Asa from the Bob's Gun mural contest. And I saw that he was from...
Bob's Gun Gun Shop is a shop in downtown Norfolk that,
yes, ma'am,
that has a side that is muralized in magnificent ways.
And that kind of was one of the first things that really kicked off the Neon District, was this big contest. And I noticed he was from Newport News. So like we do, I kind of typed in his name on Facebook, and we had some mutual friends. So I checked out his work, and... he was somebody that, like I said, I was really happy to bring into the fold. And
I think he joins us now. Asa Jackson, nice to have you with us today. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much, Kathy. It's an honor.
Oh, it's great to have you here, and great to have had the opportunity for these fine folks to profile your work. Why don't you tell us a bit about your work from your perspective? How did it evolve?
Been painting since I was a young guy. Probably got serious into art maybe in high school and in college, and after college I just kept going with it, and you know, it's blossomed as I go along.
And so you now have been so inspired by what you've been up to in this regard that you've actually opened your own gallery.
Yes. Back in 2014, me and a few friends of mine, we opened a gallery in Hampton called 670 Gallery. And the funny story is a lot of that came about because of the scene. The episode that was shot in early fall of 2014 was very monumental. Actually, the property manager where the gallery is in Peninsula Town Center called me up after seeing the video and was very inspired by it. And said, hey, come down. I got a space. I think you might be interested in checking it out. And that's how it all started.
And do you make your art there as well as show art?
No. Actually, we all the artists have their own studios, and we also have a co-working studio around the corner from the gallery. But the gallery is just set up for exhibits, so we do one-man shows and group shows pretty regularly.
And tell me about the people who come to these shows, because I think that's an interesting aspect of it. It really seems to be drawing people of all ages.
Yeah, definitely. It's sort of an eclectic mix. Each show is kind of a new crowd. We have our regulars who come back for almost everything, but with each artist or each act, so to speak, there's a whole new crowd. We've shown artists from Virginia Beach and Newport News and Hampton, all over the Hampton Roads area. And we've also been working with different artists from out of town. Some artists from Minnesota and also California have shown with us. And with each sort of new exhibit, there comes a new interest. This weekend, actually, we're opening an exhibit for Hampton Boyer called Tropical Depression. So I'm interested to see who's going to show up for that one as well.
Yeah, Tropical Depression. Now, see, there's a lot of different ways you could think about that, which I guess is a piece of the point, huh?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Gosh, Asa Jackson, what a pleasure to talk with you today. Congratulations on all of your success. We asked Sandy Curran as well, and I want to ask you, I always think it's interesting to ask artists what's next for them, because often by the time they start getting famous for a thing in their heads, they're sort of on the road and on to the next thing.
Well, you know, we're just pushing forward. This summer, I'm actually doing the second annual Cannes Festival. Last year, we kicked our first one off at Mill Point Park in Hampton, Virginia. And this year, we're spreading it out a little bit. We have events in Virginia Beach and Newport News and Hampton and Norfolk as well.
And you also
and
have
we'll
a camp coming up.
Over at 670 Gallery.
Yeah.
Bringing awareness to that.
You also have a camp coming up, which is a great opportunity for young people.
Yeah, it's just a one-week camp later in July, exposing youth to the arts. We do that through the Cannes Foundation, the nonprofit that we started late last year. It's kind of bringing more education opportunities to the youth of the area.
Well, congratulations. Where can people get information about the camp? Because a lot of people are looking for exciting things that will inspire children this summer.
You can reach out to us on our Facebook page at 670 Gallery.
Okay.
And also direct at 670gallery@gmail.com.
All right. Very good. Thank you so much for being with us today, Asa Jackson. Nice to talk with you.
All right. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Take care. We're at 28 minutes past the hour. That's Asa Jackson. He's an artist and the curator at 670 Gallery in Hampton. Kenny, did a feature on a woman named Anne Mazzocca, who's a dancer. Tell us about her.
Yes, ma'am. So Anne has a funny story, because Anne probably has popped up in more scene videos just like hanging out, just because she's always at all these other events where we're at filming. So it only made sense for us to at some point to kind of highlight her. But Anne was actually somebody who Shannon was kind of aware of the stuff that she was doing within the community. And so she brought her into the fold. The thing that's great with her is she is a dance instructor over at Christopher Newport.
Mm-hmm.
So Christopher Newport has this great kind of arts school going on right now that I think is, kind of harvesting a lot of great talent. So.
Yeah, I think she's starting to really implement a newer form of dance to the school, one that they hadn't looked at before, with a lot of the Haitian and more of the ethnic type of dancing that she does. It's very expressive. Not what you would typically think of with dancing. You know, and I think when Kenny and I first started the project, Kenny was like, oh, a dancer. I don't know, Shannon.
Yeah, I grew up, my sister is a dancer, and I went through so many ballet recitals that, like, you know, like, there's just the D word just kind of scares me.
Yeah.
So.
But I think, like, Danny's experience with, you know, Sandy, what we think of in certain medias of art and then what we experience after working with these people are oftentimes two very different things.
Yeah, this was a great example of where we kind of really learned something. So with her being so involved in this, like, Haitian folkloric kind of studies, so we learned about all these things like Oshun and how much the water was important. So then when from a creative standpoint, so then we're trying to figure out, well, how can we show her doing something great? So like I said, being from the peninsula, I knew, well, we have this great place right by CNU Lions Bridge, and I've seen some of the most beautiful sunsets I've ever seen sitting right there. So if we took her and kind of had her dancing into the sunset, it would be great visually, and I think still to this day, it was probably one of my favorite scenes that we shot.
It's called The Nature of Dance, that particular episode, and Mazaka joins us now. Nice to have you with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here with all of you.
Oh, you're welcome. So I wonder, as you know, we talked about, Shannon mentioned the nature of your dance and the sort of the culture that informs it. This idea of the combining of Haitian and Cuban. How did you come by that? And tell us how that expresses itself in your dance.
Sure. I've always danced, but I was first introduced to West African-based dance when I was in college, up at Amherst College. Actually, I just celebrated my 20th reunion this weekend, which is kind of crazy. But and then from there, I decided to continue to study, and I was studying Ghanaian dance, and then I went to graduate school at UCLA, and that's actually where I was introduced to more African diaspora forms like Haitian,
right.
Cuban, Brazilian, a lot of those forms that were happening throughout the Americas, and those folkloric forms that are coming from more sacred contexts. So when I moved to New York City back in 2001, then I was just dancing, and I had also been exploring like more contemporary postmodern dance and methods of improvisation. So in New York, I was kind of exploring all different avenues, and then I ended up starting to dance with a Haitian company. And that was sort of the beginning of the rest of my focus for several years in New York, dancing solely with Haitian folkloric companies. And then I also eventually started performing with a Cuban teacher of mine, Felix Tupiensua, who has since passed away, in his company. So that work, like that form, along with just sort of my lifetime experience in dance, is what makes up my creative voice now. But obviously, as I'm a white American woman, so a lot of the work is also about that identity,
yeah,
and my identity within those forms, like basically as an outsider, but with certain access because of my passion for it and connection to the communities that I've participated with for many years.
I always think that's such an interesting tightrope to walk in a certain sense, because, you know, you certainly don't want to be accused of appropriating, right? But you
exactly.
do want to observe and reflect and all the rest of it. It just strikes me that's a really tenuous. And if anyone could walk a tightrope, I suppose it's a dancer. But that's sort of what it feels like to me.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that. Just last week, I was collaborating with a friend of mine who's another white American woman who's very much dedicated to Haitian folkloric dance and has been connected with other African diaspora forms as well. And we kind of wanted to explore like our whiteness in relation to the dance forms that we're connected to that have an African lineage. And basically, this first section of the dance was kind of as if we were walking a tightrope. Like, that's how someone saw it. We more felt like we were in a tunnel. But someone watching us thought, like, it looked like we were a bit on a tightrope. And, you know, so those, in some ways, that's, like, the feeling of the limitation. But, you know, there isn't a limitation. Like, there's that possibility, right, for all of us to be able to explore the world and potentially embody that world. But I think it's really important to know kind of the history of these forms, how they have been appropriated, how, you know, Black culture has been exploited in the United States throughout history, you know, up until right now, that still happens in popular culture. And just like important to be aware of those dynamics and be respectful to the form. And so I've just always done my best to do that. And so that's why, you know, that's also why I think I went into education, like that aspect of, you know, I'm learning as much as I can, and I want to share that with the community that I'm in as well.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Anne Mazaka, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Kathy. Thank you so much for having me. And Shannon and Kenny.
You're most welcome. And Ann Mazzocca, by the way, is on the faculty there at Christopher Newport University, as well as in Haiti and Cuba. She dances there as well. So fascinating background. And a beautiful, beautiful piece. WHRO.org/the scene is where you can see that beautiful lyrical dancer who is Ann Mazzocca. Who talked to Christine Harris? Who did that?
Which of you?
Well, no. So Christine's actually. So this is a good point. I think where we were talking about how we troll the internet and we look for all these artists, and sometimes we do hit we hit walls, and we're looking for the right artists. And now with some of our grants, we have to focus our artists in different cities in the Hampton Roads. So there's been certain people who have led to other people. Like I think like this doing the Sky video led to doing the Jackie P video. Right.
How did we come to this one?
So Christine was from Karen and Wade. Wade were two people that we had also done in season two, Karen Longfreet and Wade Mickley. And they told us, well, you really got to check out this woman, Christine Harris. She's a really great artist. So basically she's a sculptor who does these anthropomorphic pieces who just like when you see them, you just can't believe like how incredible they are. So she's really fun, and she's also an art therapist. So she goes into and works with these kids with disabilities, and you see how like they are inspired by working with art. So
And Christine Harris joins us now, and she was featured in season 2, episode 2, and it's called Living Underground. Christine Harris, thank you for being with us today.
Hey, thank you. Everybody.
Your work is so intriguing, and I understand that you, you people have fascinating childhood experiences. For yourself, it was rolling around cemeteries with your great-grandmother.
Yep. We spent a lot of time in cemeteries.
Yeah.
I did growing up. Probably every Sunday, that was the thing to do. I don't know if it's a Southern thing. I don't know where that comes from.
Did you put flowers on graves or just visit? Because that is a very I can remember doing that as well. It's like that's what you did on Sundays or on occasions.
My grandmother would put flowers on my grandfather's grave.
Yeah.
I just was like
just
you know,
running around,
kind of a wild child running around. You know,
well,
that cemetery is pretty visible. You can see a kid fairly far away, because even though it has trees, you can see what
which,
they're up to.
Which cemetery was this?
Elmwood
Cemetery, sure.
Yeah.
And so you've got trees, you've got mausoleums, all of this around you, and it is a very evocative place. Most cemeteries are that have any age and any expanse to them. Were you aware at that time that those images were sort of imprinting on you?
Well, no, I mean, I was so young. No,
yeah.
I wasn't, but I always came back. We came back so often. I would visit this one angel, the Cooper Angel, or it's called the Recording Angel also. Every year, I still go back and see it every year. It was just something that really always stuck with me. But I just, in general, I don't know if you've been to that graveyard. It's a very beautiful graveyard.
Yes.
It's more like, it was a whole Victorian idea of death as sleep as opposed to death as the end. So it was supposed to be tranquil. Anyways, I really loved it. So,
and how do you see this in your work? Which is, it sort of defies description. It's really intriguing and evocative. But how do you make that connection from that childhood experience to your work? How is it showing itself in your work?
Well, I mean, I've always been attracted to faces, and of course, all the angels there, they have beautiful faces, and I've always been intrigued by that. But then the other, I mean, it's kind of like a collage experience, because like all of the natural elements, all these beautiful trees with these huge roots and these, oaks and so much beautiful plant activity, along with these sculptures, which I really consider beautiful. I mean, so many of them were so well done, especially the Cooper Angel, too.
Sure.
So I think that it all kind of collaged itself into a memory and experience, and it just keeps coming out.
I love the way you talk about this idea of looking up and seeing what's going on around us, and it seems to me that's a piece of what happened in the cemetery. As a child, you were able to look up and allow these images to imprint themselves.
Oh, yeah. Children don't have filters like adults do, so... I mean, I was pretty filterless.
Well, it's beautiful work. And what are you up to now? I know that you are not teaching classes anymore because you've really sort of decided to focus on your art in a full-time sort of way.
Yeah, I'm focusing full time on my art. I just got done with having a solo show at MoCA in the community gallery, which was a great experience. I'm going to teach a few classes there. I think I'm going to shift my focus to teaching after doing therapy for a while. I may go back to doing art therapy, but I think it's going to be a very part-time basis because I feel like I'm in a good frame of mind and in a good place.
I wonder how that, as an artist who allows these experiences to shape you, and also as an art therapist, I wonder if I wonder how that is. I mean, when you work with art with people who need you and need the services that you provide, how do you sort of balance the idea of being of accessing art as a therapeutic model for a patient and keeping your own artist self engaged in that as well?
Well, it's like two different modes of working almost. As a therapist, as an art therapist, I use art as a tool to understand somebody. And a lot of times I work with children, I work with older adults, and I work with people that have physical and mental disabilities. Mm-hmm. So I want, first of all, for them to be comfortable. Art's a great way to make somebody comfortable. Instead of asking them all these probing questions, you can ask them, well, why don't you sit down and draw with me, and maybe suggest, why don't you draw a house? And then we'll draw together. It's more like of a partnership. And that is how I approach, as far as my therapy life. Art is, I see, is totally separate. I feel like I guess it does affect me as a therapist in that I feel like I have to be aware of all my issues. I have to be, and not let them affect the therapeutic relationship. I have to go in there and know what my problems are.
Yeah.
Be aware of them and never let it affect, what I'm doing as a professional.
Sure. It's an amazing bit of work, and what an intriguing field of study and commitment. Christine Harris, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I hope you guys have a great day.
You too. It's ChristineKHarris.com is the website where you can see this work that really does, don't you think? It's sort of hard to describe, isn't it?
It is. I'm going to be acquiring one of the pieces that's hanging in MoCA right now.
Nice.
After the show comes down.
Well done. That's great. We're at about 18 minutes before the hour, 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240, wondering whether you have seen any of these videos that are uploaded to the Scene website, whro.org/the scene. These are designed to be screened on the web, and then they put them together into a television show that they are that is also broadcast on WHRO TV 15. So it's nice to have a couple of different platforms in which to express that work. So glad to have back with us today Bobby Black Hat Walters. He's a harmonica player, a national blues musician, and writer, and he was featured in season 3. Of the Scene. That's called A Blues Story, and Danny Epperson produced that piece. Bobby, good to talk with you today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You really strike me as one of those people who has a great gift, because you have, first of all, tremendous talent as a musician, but then you're also able to look at what goes on here at the region, have a little fun with it, and bring it to us in a musical format that we can all sort of access and commiserate with.
Well, blues is all about life, and sometimes you just have to look around and the song will write itself, and HRBT Blues is a perfect example of that.
See, I would submit that is what makes you a great artist, is that you were able to take what I think for many of us would be an experience of frustration and turn it into a creative pursuit. I don't know if you saw the piece on the news the other night about that traffic tie-up on 264, and I can't now remember the band, and I wish I could. They were sort of stuck in it. It was one of those everybody stopped evolutions, and so they got out of their cars and just kind of had a little jam session there on the on the highway.
That's awesome.
Yeah, isn't it though? But I think that there's a lot of ways we can look at the things that happen to us in life, and it strikes me that you and your colleagues have a pretty intriguing way to do that. When you worked with Danny on this piece, what were you able to share and communicate in this video format that's different than maybe what most people might think of as more of an oral connection to the music?
Well, I think that it's a community. The blues community in this area is a pretty tight community. And we all know each other. We all, you know, perform with each other. We support each other. And I think that given the opportunity to show some of that was a great pleasure for me, because I've got a lot of friends that when I first started getting serious about music were there, and, you know, you cut your teeth at the various open mics, and so they actually came out to one of the open mics that's been a long-running one at Old Town Tavern, and got to see the people who I've been playing and performing with and socializing with for many years. And so it was nice to be able to let folks know that there is a blues community, that the blues is very much alive, and that it's not just confined to some old guy sitting in a field somewhere plucking on a three-string guitar. That there's happy blues, there's fun blues, there's danceable blues, and then there's very emotional blues.
Yeah.
And I think it gave us an opportunity to kind of showcase that.
And you involve your wife and your family in the music as well, right?
Yeah, my wife performed with me last September, her first time performing with me, and recently she got bit by the bug a little bit more, so she's been on stage with me several times here recently, so I think she just got tired of me having all the fun.
There you go.
And all of my children are musicians or vocalists, and they've all either performed with me or recorded with me, so that's kind of a family affair kind of thing.
That must be a great pleasure. I mean, that just must be a remarkable moment to be recording a piece of music and know that your children are standing there doing this with you.
Well, you know, being a dad, my kids are, you know, that age, you know, college age or older, and so I get a lot of cool points now when,
yeah.
when
well,
these
yeah.
things happen. So.
I mean, there's very few people who have that experience, that's for sure.
It's a pleasure, you know, performing with them. So,
are you on the road much these days?
Well, you know, we're going to be doing a little bit more. We're stretching out a little bit more now. You know, it's always a challenge with musicians, you know, scheduling logistics. And so you really have to plan it. You know, some of my guys are still working, and so a couple of them are full-time musicians, but some of them also work and are in school. So, you know, it's a logistic challenge to get out there. But this summer we've got some gigs out of town, and hopefully we'll be able to spread our wings. That's one thing that the scene did for us. It really gave us a lot of exposure to a new audience.
Nice.
That maybe had heard the name or heard about blues but didn't really make a connection until they saw that, and then we've been contacted by quite a few folks saying, hey, we really like that. We want more, so that's a great thing.
Let's do that. All right. Well, Bobby, what a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you for all the whimsy that you bring us in the context of the blues. Thanks for all of the work that you do, and congratulations on this evolving family band here. It sounds really exciting.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for being with us. Take care.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. BobbyBlackHat.com is the website where you can learn more about Bobby Black Hat Walters. That episode was in season 3 on the scene, and Danny Epperson sort of helmed that one. We're at 13 minutes before the hour. So, Shannon, what's next on this project? Because it seems like it's gone in some places maybe you didn't original, which is a beautiful thing, right?
Yeah,
when something evolves into different
it's
places.
It's been such an amazing experience. We're just in the middle of our third season, so there's still a lot ahead of us. One of the projects that I'm working on currently that'll come out mid-June is two artists that we're putting together. One is in her 90s and one, I think, is in her late 20s. And you would think that they're very different, but they're actually very similar. And in doing so, we've actually created an art show for them that's going to be at the Slover on Saturday, June
4th.
Oh,
nice, nice.
So if that project doesn't kill me, it'll be really good. But, you know, so just learning how to see something and recognizing there's a story there. And I think I learned a lot of that from Kenny working with him. This was a very new experience for me. So just trying to identify that story and try to tell it. You know, so really just trying to get through the season.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And next week, we've got Mary Lee Cleveland, a bronze sculptor, coming up.
Yes, ma'am. So she is another one that Danny's kind of taken the helm on and worked real hard. And she seems, all the footage and stuff I've seen, looks really, really great. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited for it.
So that's going to be, and when does that post, or when does that?
So they come out Wednesday nights at 7:57.
Wednesday nights at 7:57. That's the beauty of this, doing these things online, too, is that, you know, mm-hmm. post it when it's ready, right? So you shoot for 7:57 every
it's
Wednesday.
Always
night.
Up on 7:57. Yeah. It might be a couple minutes early if you tune in early. You can find it on whro.org/the scene. You can find it on all of our Facebook pages, Twitter accounts. Like, we just splatter it everywhere.
All right. Very good. Well, great pieces of work, and you can see those as well on WHRO TV 15 from time to time at the end of the season. We put them all together. and sort of share them with you that way too. So lots of great work there. Thanks to both of you for being with us today. And are we going straight to Michael? Yes. Okay. This is how you know it's live, folks. Glad to have Michael Candlewall back with us today. And I'm going to tell you something. You talk about something that has grown and expanded over time that was just a little kernel of a great idea, and that is the Muse Writers Center. Michael's the executive director there. Michael, nice to have you back with us.
Oh, thanks, Kathy. It's wonderful to be with you this afternoon. And thank you so much for your support and your listeners' support all these years. We really appreciate it.
Well, I think you and I are the only ones who are old enough to remember the back in the day, right? When it was you and a table, right?
Well, it was us. We were borrowing space from different art schools at first.
Right.
We started about 10 years ago, and this is our 10-year anniversary. We just moved into a brand new space in central Ghent at the Ghent Market Shops, right next to Plaza del Sol and A.W. Schott.
I tell you, I saw the space the other day, and I just thought, wow, they grow up so fast. It is, you know, this is a great story because it's about a small group of very creative people who really had a vision to start a writer's center. Lots of people in Hampton Roads love to write, and they were really the ones who came together, stuck with this. 10 years on, it has grown and blossomed in the most beautiful way. You just finished, and I'm not sure I have this pronunciation right. Pecha Kucha?
Well, yeah. So Pecha Kucha is a sort of a miniature TEDx kind of thing where I think 800 cities across the world do this presentation where people have 20 slides and they show them for 20 seconds each and then speak during that time. They can do a creative performance or an informational performance. And we had our first night last Thursday at Work Release in the Arts District in Norfolk. And Selena Santos has headed that up. She's one of our students and one of our friends. And it was a really fun night. We had, I think, 60 or 70 people showed up and for some great presentations.
It's a very interesting idea. The idea is to present 20 slides for 20 seconds, each along with words and music, and, you know, it's just kind of what is creative about you. So there it is. The reason we wanted to talk with you today especially is that summer is a time when people's work schedules generally dial back just a little bit. I'm told that anyway. Hasn't happened for me yet, but I'm told it does happen for some people.
I've heard that too.
Right. So we know that there are a lot of summer classes and seminar opportunities there. And so if somebody has the Great American Novel in them or wants to explore a related field, you have some great options for the summer.
Well, yeah, so we have about 75 different classes and seminars this summer in poetry, fiction, memoir, nonfiction, screenwriting, songwriting, food writing, comic book writing. And we also have them from geared toward beginners all the way to advanced writers. So there's something for everybody at the Muse Writers Center. And we have morning classes, evening classes, and also weekend classes. And the really important thing I like to always say is that our prices are not very high for tuition. You know, an 8-week class would be about $230. But we have, and we're sort of unique in this amongst writer centers and literary centers across the country, we have a pretty extensive tuition assistance program. So we believe that economic diversity is important and that people shouldn't ever be turned away from being creative because of money. So if someone out there wants to take a class and can't afford the entire amount, we can certainly make it happen for them.
Oh, it's such a great idea. And you're also doing some calligraphy classes this summer, so it's really sort of expanding out in some respects, some songwriting classes, script writing, and then, of course, your traditional poetry, novels, writing for magazines and the like. And some great opportunities this summer for kids and teens. There's not a better way you could have your child spend a week or so this summer than exploring that.
Most of our classes are for adults, but we do have a very strong teen program and preteen and young writers program. So we have ongoing classes for 9 to 11-year-olds and 12 to 17-year-olds, but also we have three different camps in August for them as well, sort of day camps, the week of August 8th. So for 7 to 8-year-olds, it's a camp, for 9 to 11-year-olds, it's a camp, and also for 12 to 17-year-olds.
You've also done a great job of launching the Hampton Roads Writers Conference that's coming up again for the 8th time, hard to believe, this fall.
Well, we didn't launch it, but we are proud partners of Hampton Roads Writers, and their conference is the weekend of September 15th.
Oh, got it. I apologize. See, people who do these hard things should get full credit. So thank you for being so generous with that, Michael.
Well, they are good friends of ours, and we are a sponsor of the conference. A lot of our students go.
Got it.
It's a really great time for writers to have a sort of a weekend where they can meet other writers and take some seminars and also meet agents and have some social time too.
And you can learn about that at HamptonRoadsWriters.org. It's coming up September 15th through 17th, which right now feels like forever from now, but I promise you, you're going to get halfway through the summer. It's going to be July 4th, and you're going to be thinking, what did I do? What? And you're going to want to sign up for it, and it's going to be sold out. So you want to go ahead and do that now, September 15th through 17th, HamptonRoadsWriters.org. Michael, congratulations on all that you've accomplished here with the Muse Writers Center. It's a really impressive list of classes, and the thing that's so great about it is that you really are taking in the community's input on that as well, and bringing classes that reflect what the community wants to do.
Thank you so much, Kathy. You know, our classes actually start tomorrow, and we'd love to have people check us out at www.the-muse.org.
Fantastic. Michael, good to talk with you. Thanks again.
Thank you, Kathy.
You bet. Brew at the Zoo and Vino 2 is coming up this week, Thursday, June 2nd from 6 to 9 at the Virginia Zoo. That's going to be sponsored by the Cultural Alliance of Greater Hampton Roads. They're going to have tastings of all kinds of craft beers and local breweries and music, all kinds of fun things there, and artwork and local tattoo artists. Wait a minute, let me back that up. They're not going to have people doing tattoos there. It's going to be artwork by local tattoo artists. Don't get excited, people. And there's going to be a silent auction as well. Lots of breweries as well. CulturalAlliance.org. CulturalAlli, CulturalAlli.org is the website where you can check that out. That's coming up Thursday, June 2nd, 6 to 9 at the Virginia Zoo from our good friends over at the Cultural Alliance of Greater Hampton Roads. Thanks so much for being with us today. We've got some interesting stuff coming up next right here on 89.5. Up next is the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Our good friend Clay Jenkinson will be with us. Then coming up tonight on WHRO TV 15, it's the Genealogy Roadshow. They head over to Houston, down to Houston, I should say, to investigate a reenactor's Texas roots and uncover one woman's link to a prominent Texas figure. So that's coming up tonight at 8. Then at 9 o'clock, it's Secrets of the Dead, Jamestown's Dark Winter. I've seen this before. It's a fantastic program. Forensic anthropologists looking at the early American colony and uncover dark secrets. It's a really fascinating look at something that is very close to us, and so you can check that out this summer. Start it out with that show tonight, Secrets of the Dead, at 9 o'clock on WHRO TV 15. Then at 10 o'clock, it's Frontline. They're taking a look at the fantasy sports gamble, looking into sports, fantasy sports and online sports betting, and tracing the growth of those businesses. And if you've been listening to NPR, you know those have grown significantly because there's been lots of coverage of that in the last year or so. Tomorrow, right here on Hearsay, we'll be taking a look at Hampton Roads Pride Fest coming up soon, and we'll give you all the information you need to know about that. And a reminder that this weekend, it's hard to believe, is the 40th anniversary of Harbor Fest. Can you believe that? What an amazing event that has turned into, certainly significant and iconic for the region. So 40 years of Harbor Fest coming your way this very weekend. They'll start managing traffic downtown about midday Friday, so that's a little bit of a heads up for you. But it's going to be a great event, as it always is. Let's just hope for good weather. So that's coming up this weekend in Hampton Roads. Thanks so very much for being with us today. It's always nice to have you in the conversation, and we'll look forward to seeing you right here tomorrow. Put on your red shoes. Put on